This is a set of short texts from Ajahn Chah. This is from the Thai forest tradition. He's dead now. So maybe that was his footsteps. Maybe he was the ghost. Saying, come on, Nu, get it together. And he was a monk in Thailand who he changed a tradition, a rustic forest tradition that had already been going for a long time. But a lot of the monks were very solitary. And so they would kind of get enlightened or think they were enlightened because they spent a lot of time alone. And then when they were in the company of other people, it was not so easy. And he realized that this was a problem. So he created more than 350 forest monasteries, very basic monasteries in the jungle in Thailand, so that people could meditate in their huts alone, but also have problems with the washing up, you know? Like, whose turn is it to do the washing up? And I want to meditate, but we need to mix some cement and, you know, all this. And this has been a big influence for me, this tradition. And this mixing, this coming together of the here gathered in ourselves, having our processes, and also the sharing of community and how we relate with others. Because so often, this is where things start to bounce around, and there's a bit of a rub. It's with other people, hey, and what we think others should be doing, or how we should be, and you know, all of this. So, my main influence, I think, is this tradition, the Ajahn Chah tradition, and then also some open spirituality. My main teacher, who is Jaya Ashmore, does deep rest meditation. So that was like 4 days later, I'm introducing myself a bit better. Cool. Be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become quiet in any surrounding. It will become still like a clear forest pool, and all kinds of wonderful and rare animals will come to drink from it. Then you will clearly see the nature of all things in the world. You will see many wonderful and strange things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. So I wanted to like flow on from just the simple stillness, observing, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and the sensations coming from all of this. So the anchoring in the body is the first foundation of mindfulness. And the observation of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral sensations is the second foundation of mindfulness. And the third is mind moves, like the weather we're watching. And they do, like I was saying on the first day, I think that they're kind of separate categories. In the way that in Buddhism they like to make categories and have numbers and stuff. If you can count up to five, it's normally okay. But it just makes it easier to remember stuff. And these categories, they are different, but they also interweave, you know, in the way that the first foundation of mindfulness is like... I mean, it's a vast subject and there's many chapters, but the body and anchoring into your body is, of course, going to come into the second foundation of mindfulness. which is when you're observing pleasant, unpleasant, you're going to observe that in the body. Hey. So in that way, they interweave, they get mixed in. You know? And in this way, also mind moods, we're going to feel our mind moods in our body as well. They're going to have an effect. It's not just the thinking mind that's having the different moods. It's the effect on the body. And that's often how we recognize them, actually. When we come to listening to the body sensation, and we could have a, say, like a difficult mood or emotion of some sort, and we can really it seeps into our body, it leaks into our body as well, until we don't know what is mind and what is body and what's the difference, no? Because they kind of, they weave into each other. So the proposition is to also observe these mind states like a weather person. So just checking out, what's the weather now in my mood? And there can be a same sort of equanimity that comes just from the exercise in a way of observing instead of going into and being dipped or drowned in the mood. The fact of wanting to just sit with it, see what's happening now, what's happening now. What's my mood today? What's the weather like? Equanimity is like a balancedness. To be equanim is to not tip into the extreme. In this context, the extreme of being pulled into, say you're feeling sad. You go, what's happening now? Ah, there's a sadness. It's raining inside today in me, you know? The clouds are grey. That song, hey, California Dreaming. And the fact of being more of being curious about that, about what your mood is, instead of your mood raining on you until you're totally taken by the mood and you don't even know that you're in that mood hardly. Or it's so full on that you're drowning in it, you know? And that the equanimity comes from the exercise of going, what's the weather like today? And what's the effect on my body? What's the effect of the feeling of, say, sadness in my body? Do you know what I mean? And we could have like a backdrop sadness that we're hardly aware of. And then bringing it into awareness, it could become more, where am I feeling it? Oh, I'm feeling a real heartache today. Or a melancholia. Oh, it's actually quite nice. And then there's, pleasant. You know, it's actually pleasant. Oh, I like that. This melancholic feeling of whatever, you know, of my romantic sad life or whatever we add on. Like in a painting or a film or something, the piano player. Or it could, you know, it could go flow on from that to that sadness of, oh my God, my life's so terrible, I must change it, and I'm no good, and we go down into a dark pit or whatever. So there's the pleasant and unpleasant in that, in these mind moods. And there's that very kind of neutral where we don't have a strong feeling about something, where it's just as it is, you know. Maybe other people have strong opinions and feelings about something, and they're getting really, well, we must do something about it, and let's have a meeting, and you're like, that's not something that bothers me, you know. We're neutral. And feeling into that neutral feeling, and whether that's a kind of just a not caring, an indifference, because we're not feeling very passionate about life, because we're a bit down. So is that neutral a kind of pushing down of life? Or is it a more kind of balanced, a place we could find some equanimity in that neutrality? So I'm sure you've had many mind states, no? In the last few days. Many moods, no? Many moods that are probably not the same as they were 3 days ago, no? There's been some change, no? And this is the fun of, this is the good crack about retreats and meditation, no? Is that we get to have this time off to notice the changingness, the impermanence of our moods, of our sensations. The sensation that 2 days ago was unpleasant is now moved on to something more neutral or something pleasant, and vice versa. You know? The mood that you came with to the retreat might have a different flavour now. So there's this changingness. And this is the gift, in a way, of a retreat, is being able to have this little bit time off from our daily lives, hey, to notice this changingness, not just in our thinking mind, but in our bodies, to really notice this. So there are, in classical Buddhist teachings, there are what they call the five obstacles to meditation. And they are, I know there's many more obstacles, but they put them into these very simple five categories. And in the Ajahn Chah tradition, or as Ajahn Chah, this monk from Thailand, taught it, it was that these, what are called obstacles, are actually friendly tools. So in the broader Buddhist world, they're called obstacles or hindrances, something that stops us. And he used to say, no, these are tools. With these hindrances, we can get enlightened by getting to know the hindrances, by getting to know these obstacles to meditation is a route to enlightenment. And he would discourage people from just staying in the very blissful states where everything's peaceful and perfect. And so he would encourage people to still their minds and bodies, to calm, but not to get carried away with the very high blissful states of calm. A little bit the same practice as saying to the monks, come from your forest alone and let's see about if we have any problems with washing up. You know, this basic problem of life, how do we share? It's a bit the same thing. He would say, no, don't push away these obstacles and grasp for the higher states. Get to know them. Get to know these obstacles, so that they are friendly tools that will guide us along the way. So these five obstacles, two of them we've been working with for 2 days already. Desire and aversion. We've been doing this, hey. The towards, wanting, and the craving, the thirst for something, and the suffering that comes from that. And the pushing away, the resistance, the not wanting, the suffering that comes from that. So the other three are sleepiness, or because there can be sleepiness where we just have had a busy life and we need to to actually have more hours of sleep, but a kind of dullness of the mind, a kind of not where the, where we close our eyes to meditate, things are not very bright. It's a kind of under some heaviness, you know? So a dullness, a lethargy, this is the same category, hey? The third one, I'm still talking about, I'm just using different words for it. So a kind of dullness, a lethargy, no energy. No energy for practice. Not very motivated. And kind of fuzzy, unclear. And the fourth one is the opposite, restlessness, agitation. Too much stimulation. Too much thinking, too much stirred up. And the fifth one is doubt, where we're constantly not confident in our own intuition and wisdom, and we're constantly questioning it, you know, everything. Questioning if we're doing the right meditation, if this feeling is okay to be here, if I should be like this instead, or should I be like that, or should they be like this, or should they be like that? Should the teacher be talking about this, or should the food be like this? So not in that in just criticism, I'm saying just doubting, not being sure and doubting and hesitating about everything. And in that total state of hesitation all the time, there's not a lot of tranquility, no? It's difficult to settle and to anchor into our body. But from an anchored place, we can sit and we can observe these friendly tools as they arise. And they do so often on retreats. These five come up all the time, all the time, all the time. They just have different names for different people or different flavors because of somebody's... someone's journey, they'll come out in a slightly different way. But I almost know always on the third or the fourth day, there is many of these obstacles that people will come and talk about as a problem. It's like, you're talking about peacefulness, but I'm agitated. Or, you know, you're talking about easefulness, but all I can feel is sleepiness and dullness. And, you know, and these obstacles are also like present naturally in our daily lives, as most stuff in meditation is as well. Yeah.
Can you write down those five things and then can somebody maybe translate them in English? I understand what you are talking about, but yeah. I would like to get them.
Sure, sure. But I can just say them now and somebody could translate. Who's good, feels like translating? All right. So, desire. Aversion. That's a lot of synonymous. I like it. Things are getting rich here. I'm almost lost. Yeah, lethargy or dullness. All of that. They're saying nothing. Agitation. Agitation or restlessness. And doubt. And I can write it down. And so we can see them as enemies to meditation. And we can really feel like I'm not meditating properly because I have these coming. So Noon says, sit there and anchor in the body and then open to wide awareness. And I did all that. And then these things come in, these demons come, you know, and we can go, oh, and so I'm not a good meditator. And we can feel bad about it and all this, you know. But these are just what comes. This is, and then these are the the materials to meditate with. And through the understanding and the getting to know how we relate to these, comes more fluidity on the path, comes more ease in life, actually. Comes more freedom. As I've been saying for the last 2 days, you know, with the pleasant and unpleasant, which is also desire and aversion, same thing. The observation of that, the being aware of that, feeling it in our everyday lives outside of meditation, it really changes our life. Because all day long, from the minute we wake up, it's beginning, no? This. The pleasant, unpleasant sensation. Desire, aversion. Want this, don't want that. Not enough energy. Dull mind. Or too agitated. Or just doubting. Not being able to settle. Doubting. Hesitation, doubting. Which has a lack of, kind of like a not enough confidence in it somewhere. That at some point we just need to try, you know? And some people have more of one than the other. We have certain tendencies, you know. And we also have phases in our life when we have more than one, more of one than the other. And we have phases in our life when we're more restless, and phases when we're more dulled out, where things are all a bit same, you know. And we don't feel the bright passion of the pure existence of our wonderful lives. And sometimes there's mixes of them, you know? So they're all part of our lives. But when we sit in meditation, they become very, well, they can, if we want to look out for them, they become quite obvious. And so there's various ways to work with them. And I would say that my personal experience with any of these is to feel them in the body, to feel in the body so that we know them. And instead of them catching us from behind and knocking us over, because we know the feeling of them, we recognize them quickly. So someone was speaking about, you know, the quick reactivity of something, when we react quickly to something. Because we don't know the feeling of it. We're not aware that that's what's in us. And then we're reacting before we know it. But with this awareness of the sensations in the body, then it's more like you're on a big plane and you see some horses galloping and you see the dust coming over there already. Instead of suddenly the horses are there, you know? You see it coming from much further away. And you can go, I see you. And this is what the Buddha said to his demons. He said, I see you, Mara. Mara is the name for the demons in our minds. I see you, Mara. Meaning, and he would like talk to them. Don't think that I can't see you, demons, in my own mind, you know. I see you coming, doubt. I see your little game, you know. I feel my restlessness. I feel you, lethargy. I know you, desire. I know you, aversion. I know what you feel like. My body. And this can be helpful. So to be experimented with yourself. What I've found helpful with like very intense emotions is to be to try to catch them and practice with them as they start. So the image that I had some one day was almost like a mudslide, you know, like a very strong emotion could start here and go fall down me this way, or sometimes start here and go this way up my body from the pelvis upwards, you know, like a funnel shape, like this. And that the practice of when it starts to slide, instead of being caught and sliding off and drowning in it and being destabilized by it, to try to practice staying with its movement, with the movement of the strong emotion, whether that be aversion or desire or some of the cousins of those, hey, because we know that aversion and desire, they have many. It's a big world. Desire and aversion is a big world, hey. It's like thousands of emotions in all of those. But to stay with it, to stay present in your body in those moments. For example, say you're at the place that's often challenging is like you're in your family, you know, at a big Christmas thing or something. And somebody says something to you, and for example, they're saying, I'll take an example from my life. They're saying something like I was when I was 5 years old, you know, but now we're like 50 years later, you know, so I'm not like that anymore. It's obvious. But there's that projection that's not true. And you feel this thing that you feel in your family often, you know, because your family's often seeing you in a quite a fixed way, you know? And that's difficult to handle. So you feel this like this anger coming up. And to stay with that anger, not to control it, not to repress it or something like that, but to feel and be present with that in your body in that moment. And it kind of gives a time to take a breath. And then if the person is still there who said the thing that they probably know is not very true, you know, and not very kind or whatever. With that presence, sometimes there's the space to say, you know what you just said there? Actually, no, you know, and to correct that view. And sometimes it's not important that you actually say something. Sometimes it's just your own feeling of not being completely thrown off by your own emotion, your own emotional reaction to something, but being able to stay seated with that and feel in your belly. And because emotions travel very quickly through your body. I think that they've done some scientific tests and it's like 90 seconds, you know, like normally in your bloodstream and everything, like anger is 90 seconds and it's gone. But there can be, when it's unconscious, there can be a blocking in of it, holding on to it, a blocking in. And that presence of feeling the movement of the intense emotion, we can get to know it, become familiar with it, not to stick to it, but just to recognize it, because we don't want to necessarily hold on to it. But with some recognition and knowing, you can, oh, there's that really contracted feeling here that comes when I have this type of emotion. I get like this. And then we can go, oh, yeah. And that gives us some space to find some ease again and some equanimity, to refind our equanimity. Or to explore a little bit more what is on those emotions, What kind of charge do they have? You know, does this emotion or this mood, does this mood have a strong emotion behind it that has a something that comes from some experience before or some belief that I have? That's staying present with it, with the mood as it's there. We can inquire into it and then make a decision on how we're going to relate to it. Like some things, as I was saying to someone this morning, I think some kind of thoughts and mind states won't let us go. And we can recognize in our body the obsessiveness of it. You know? Like when people say, oh, in my meditation, I can't stop thinking, you know? I can't stop. I get hold of something gets hold of me, and then it just keeps going, 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 you know? And I can't let it go. And with that, there's the possibility of, like with a small puppy dog, you know, that's got your shoe and it won't let go of your shoe. And you go like this, come on, let go, let go, let go. And in the same way that we won't let go of a thought that's going like this, that's spinning, you know. But we can find a biscuit and say to the dog, "Hee, little doggy," and then we get our shoe back quick, no? So we can do a distraction. We can find some, when we recognize this is not so good for me, this obsessive going into this mood, going into this kind of thinking, it's not good for me. We can try a distraction technique. And this is really, really fine, you know, in this situation to recognize this. Oh, I don't feel good in my body with that. And what could that be for you? You know, that's something to contemplate. What would help you to turn your thoughts in a different direction? Because you know that that direction is not helpful. And as someone was saying today, there's also the method of just going, stop. You know? And he was saying another word. Hey, can I say it? Yeah? You have to say chop. And I like that because you could do it with your hands. You could even do that. You know, people think you're just crazy, but that doesn't matter, no? You're just having some obsessive thing going on and just chop. Enough. Or you could go, yuck, walk off. That's another way. Just tell it to go, you know? And in really classical Buddhist teachings, there's a method that they talk about that I'm not sure about. But I'm going to tell you it anyways. And that is you just clench your teeth and you just meditate on the breath. And you go, okay, I'm just going to sit through this. I'm just going to sit it out, you know, until this thing that keeps going on at me goes away. I'm not so sure about that method myself. So these are what we're calling friendly tools. And so it's like changing our perspective from something that we could possibly perceive as negative into, here's something I can practice with. So instead of the desire and aversion, sleepiness and agitation and doubt being something that we're going to get into a fight with, try and push away and feel bad about, think that we're not good meditators or not good at life or whatever, it can be like, here's one of those friendly tools. and getting to know it and its funny games. It's going to be a dance we can do together so that I can know myself better. I can know how it works. And often the way that we work with these five obstacles or relate to them is kind of individual to our conditioning and kind of also universal. If they could actually test what anger feels like in us, I think often the actual body sensation would be pretty similar, no? Or being in love or sad, you know? And we know this from reading books, no? When they describe these emotions, we go, ah, yes, I know that emotion. Because millions of humans have had those emotions for millions of years. So there's a kind of individualness and a kind of not at all. And that's so funny that most of the stuff that the human issues that the Buddha was talking about 2,600 years ago, the Buddha that we know of now, they're still the same issues nowadays. So they're definitely human stories, hey? That just come as part of the package of being human, you know, these issues. So I think it's nearly time to finish this, but I just want to put a last little thing in that maybe I'll talk about more tomorrow. And that is, there is also the possibility to be on the lookout, on the feel out for what's not there, for the absence of these hindrances, for the absence of, like in a very simple terms, noticing when our mind is not contracted. Noticing when our mind, body, heart is not craving something, wanting something, needing something. Noticing, going, ah, the mind is not dulled out today. It's not lethargic. It's energetic. Or, oh, there's no restlessness today, no agitation in this moment. There's no agitation. How does my mind feel when there's no agitation? So as much as we can be kind of like, almost like we're fishing, you know, we're in our little boat on the lake and we have a string tied here with a little thing. So we can, because it's a nicer image to not have a hook, because that's horrible for the fish, you know, we could say there's no hook, there's just some nice food. Yeah? Yeah? It's good. So we have our little string and we've got some nice cushions and we're on our little boat in the lake alone. A little string tied and on the end it goes in the water and there's some nice food for the fish. And we're just waiting to see what's going to bite on the thing there, you know. So we can just sit there on our little boat, see. And maybe it will be agitation will come, you know, or desire, aversion, dullness, doubt. Or maybe it will be, ah, what's here now? What's here now? Absence of agitation. Absence of desire. Absence of resistance. There's no resistance in my mind now. What's that like? In my body. What's that like? And this, in Buddhist terms, is called cessation. So observing cessation is also a path to enlightenment. Observing the absence. And we have many, many more moments when these are absent than we realize, you know, because the presence of these so-called obstacles are intensely felt, whereas the absence of them are not intensely felt. So we don't notice them. You know, It's almost like we notice the negative more than the positive sensations in the body, or a bit easier, you know? So it's a little bit like, because I've lived in caravans a lot of my life, in a more kind of gypsy lifestyle. And I noticed that the difference is when you're in a house, you just go, oh, it's bad weather, not going outside today. You know? When you live in a caravan, you almost live outside. And then you go, oh, well, it was rainy 5 minutes ago and now it's not. So I'll go out and have my tea outside. You notice a lot more the bits when it's not rainy. When there's the little bit in the day and you speak to somebody who lives in a house and they're like, oh, it was raining all yesterday. I didn't go out. I stayed inside with the heating. And living in a caravan, you go, oh, but I was outside chopping wood for half an hour. So, and then I went for a walk and then they've gone, da, 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 you know. And it's the same with this. There is many moments when we are not contracted, when we are not in aversion, we are not in one of these obstacles. And these are important to get to know, that we become familiar with these other mind states, the more relaxed ones, when there's no problem. Get to know our happy mind. Get to be good friends with it. And then we can easier access it. We can easier call on the happy mind when we need it. We can easier dwell there, live there, in that place. And if you're wondering what to do in meditation, there's some ideas. Thank you. I hope there's not too much words. But we can always come back and ask questions tomorrow, you know, about all of these ways. Yeah?